This edition of The Culture Show with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 18th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 36th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we've not been sleeping, we've been drinking too much, we've mislaid our passport and the cat's living with the neighbours. That's right, we're all over the place. Actually, we mean literally. First of all, we paid our yearly visit to the small Swiss town with the world's biggest art fair to see who's been buying, what the word on the carpeted aisle was, and whether Art Basel is still king of the fairs.
I think the people in the education systems here are so wonderfully trained at looking at art, and I think so many families raise children with the idea that culture is integral to their upbringing.
We'll also welcome the toothsome and tuneful London-based singer-songwriter Beattie Wolf to Midori House for a yummy live session before she embarks on a US tour.
In the States, generally, people love it all the time, and that's really great.
And we chat to film director Joe Bullman about the secret history of our streets, as his canny and critical lens bores down into the map of London to reveal what lies beneath.
We really let the people, the past, the former and present residents of those streets, tell us their story. And I think that's something that's a little bit different about the films.
Plus, we'll head to Poland and the European Football Championship for our 1 minute of sound. Expect a roar or two from that, and we visit the North by Northeast Music Conference in Toronto. That's a packed hour to enjoy, we hope, here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. To kick us off, Londoner Beattie Wolf dropped by for a chat and a Midori House session. From it, this, a new song called Thinking for Two.
Maybe I'm wrong to behave like I do. Guess I'm not used to thinking for two. And I never lie, but I bent the truth too many times, and there's no excuse. So I pick a fight, I stamp my feet, pretend it's all you. We know that it's me, and you wait it out. It must be hard to love something more, the more that it scars. Baby, let's not compete, no. One of us will surely lose. This little truce, and I try to think for two. Maybe I'll learn, I get there with time. See what it's worth to keep you on side. The sound and the fury of too many fights fades in the light of you by my side. So we will keep walking, and we will play on. I gave you my word, I'll try to stay strong. 'Cause I'm not the best at thinking for two. Maybe I'll try with you. Baby, let's not compete, no. One of us will surely lose. And take this little truce, and I try to think for two. Baby, let's not compete, no. One of us will surely lose. This little truce, and I try to think for two. Do 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 do, 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 do. And I try to think for all two.
How lovely that was. More from Beattie Wolfe later on, a wee chat and a brace more songs. Now to Switzerland. I hopped on the early plane to Basel last week with many a besuited gallery owner and shopping list toting art collector to visit the 43rd edition of Art Basel, the world's preeminent art fair. The fair always makes the biggest news for sales, trends and high-rolling attendees, but how does the fair fare in an increasingly crowded marketplace?
My name's Charlotte Burns. I'm the art market editor and the US news editor for the art newspaper. I think there's a lot of anticipation leading up to Basel because it really has the reputation of being the preeminent fair in the art world. This year we've seen an explosion of art fairs, and Basel closes off the art fair marathon that began 6 weeks ago with Frieze New York, moved to Asia 2 weeks later with Art Hong Kong, and is now closing here. And so with so much competition, it's been interesting to ask dealers whether Basel has retained its crown, and the answer is yes, it has. People save their best work for this fair.
My name is Adam Scheffer, and I'm a partner at the Chaiman Reed Gallery from New York, and we've been coming to Art Basel for 10 years now.
You guys have got a lot of jet lag this year. This is kind of your sixth or eighth week on the trot of art fairs. Do you still hold sort of your great stuff back for Basel? How do you choose what to put on the walls here?
Art Basel is always the gold standard, there's no question about it. And we like to think that each of our booths is curated specifically for the audience of each art fair. So one is not necessarily better than each other. This one just tends to be the ones where you bring sort of the most dynamic, the most expensive, the most engaging work. You also have a large amount of space to work with, which is very exciting. I think it's interesting because people are starting to weigh the differences between all of the fairs because there are so many of them. And I think the only healthy way to look at it is that if you see one as a curatorial project differently from another, I think it's always going to be fresh for whoever comes. Whether I'm in Basel, or I'm in Miami, or Hong Kong, or New York, or London, or Paris, you're never going to find flip-flops on my feet. So I might be a little bit different than that. Is one more serious than another?
But why is Basel such a good place to have a fair in the first place?
Well, it's really hard to say. I think that because you're in Basel, you're in Western Europe, I think the people in the education systems here are so wonderfully trained at looking at art, and I think so many families raise children with the idea that culture is integral to their upbringing, that you have people who are more conditioned to looking at art in what we call a serious way.
Stephen Friedman of London's Stephen Friedman Gallery is heading for some sort of Basel anniversary.
This is my 14th participation in Art Basel. I'm a relative youngster compared to some of my colleagues who have been doing this for much longer than I have. This is really the king of the art fairs. We do 5 art fairs a season. London, Miami, New York, Hong Kong, and now on Basel, of course. This is always my favorite.
Does Basel sort of bring them all together, or is it sort of defining itself differently now against all those other fairs?
It does, because especially now, given how sophisticated the market has become and diverse, I think people really are looking for the very best material available at the moment, and I think people realize that a lot of the gallerists save their very best work for Basel, and this is a time of year where you really get to see a proper cross-section of work by some of the world's most established contemporary artists, and the great thing about Basel is it mixes the very classical and the contemporary. So you have the very long established galleries downstairs, many of whom have done museum shows. There are often galleries that show work that are absolutely not available for sale, but they'd rather do a really wonderful presentation of an artist's work because it's really important for the artist's career.
Yes, perhaps surprisingly, even at the fair, it's not all about sales, but projecting for the future, perhaps.
How do you decide what to put on the walls here in your booth? Is it sort of about judging the market, or can you be quite selfish and sort of didactic with what you want to put up?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, we save material all year round for the art fairs. We're very specific about the type of material we bring. We're very particular about the freshness of the material. We're only going to bring material that is works that have not been offered before. And we save, I would say, the very best of the material for Basel. It's not specifically market-driven. It's the moment to highlight the most representative aspect of an artist's work, or perhaps a new direction. This is the time to really show it to the world, because this is the most knowledgeable, sophisticated, in-tune audience.
So it seems there's a level of old European cultivation that sets Basel apart.
Okay, I'm Luisa Estrina. I have a gallery in São Paulo, Brazil. I think in Basel it's more sophisticated and more traditional. The public is more specific. Even at the Documenta, it was very specific people. Not so many collectors, which is fun to see. More curators than anywhere.
In Basel, is there a kind of good mix of collectors and curators?
No, here we have everybody's here. Everybody who is interested in art, who collects and who curates, I think from everywhere is here.
Do you think Basel needs to be careful of its kind of reputation? Or is it still kind of the solid gold art fair in the middle of the summer for Europe and the rest of the world?
No, I think that all the galleries collect their works during the year to bring to Basel. We save things, we don't sell, just to bring them here.
However, are brains allied different for sales? Charlotte Burns thinks perhaps they might be.
There's a disparity at the moment between the market and the survey shows we're seeing in Europe. We did some number crunching at the paper and found that the market is, you know, there's a huge preponderance of works by American male artists and followed swiftly by British and German artists. Whereas if you look at the figures for the artists showing in Documenta and any of the other sort of huge survey exhibitions in Europe right now, it's the other way, that the American male artists aren't really featuring in the European shows. So that's an interesting sort of bifurcation. And there is such a thing as art fair art, that certain things sell better than they look in Documenta, which is meant to be a sort of edgy, more conceptual, thought-provoking, authored vision of a curator.
So what do you do if you want to stay edgy? Fill a hanger with conceptual art, that's what. It's called Art Unlimited, and its curator is Gianni Yetzer.
I think it's a subtle show with multiple layers. I was quite confident, actually, that the concept would work and that all these visual axes would draw you in. I open up a lot. I mean, all the walls that I possibly could open and present in an open way, I did. And also, if you walk through, actually, all the side axes always open up views and vistas to other artworks.
It is still art in a Messeplatz rather than a museum, and I suppose the context and the door through which you walk to enter the place and the reputation of the place plays a lot of the part of what you're trying to tackle, I guess, right?
It's a very interesting format because the selection is made by a committee of dealers, and there is a professional curator who is hired on one hand as a consultant, on the other hand to build the architecture and to create a display that helps the art to unfold. And it's within an art fair situation, but still the way the walls are built and the setting set up, the goal is clearly that it has actually the authority of a museum without being a museum.
So there we have it. Gianni Yetzer sees his Art Unlimited show as being absolutely distinct from the fair next door. Finally, Charlotte Burns thinks the economy, the famous art market, dictates what goes on everyone's walls.
And while it's true that Basel is never really the home for more experimental things, I think this year you can see that people are slightly more concerned about the economy. And, you know, they have to keep hold of that supply. You have to get great works. If you have those, they'll sell. But that's really what people are looking for.
And how does that work? How do galleries actually source this stuff in order to ensure that they've got an exciting prospect to show buyers at the King of the Fairs here?
Well, it's really the dealers need to know where the bodies are buried.
That was Charlotte Burns, art market editor for the Art newspaper, dispensing her wisdom with me at Art Basel. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and we're back with a bit more BT Wolf after this.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop on all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
Premiering on monocle.com, a film about the city we feel ranks number one for quality of life. Monocle's annual survey goes beyond the basic economic and social aspects of a city, identifying often overlooked factors that can bring happiness and ease to everyday life. And for the second time running, climbing back up to the number one spot, it's Zurich.
On a sunny early summer's day in Zurich, a handful of its residents have made their way to Bad Enge, one of several bathing houses situated along the waterfront, offering decks for sunbathing, bars, and even saunas. The scene is especially notable for taking place minutes from downtown, and it's what sets Zurich immediately apart. This is a city with abundant and interconnected green space, cut through by rivers leading to its lake, all of it set up to be enjoyed by the population.
You can watch this film plus our top 25 most livable city countdown on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture. Hope you enjoyed the first track from Miss Wolf and her pack. To investigate the bright mind behind the guitar and the voice, I sat down with Beattie for a chat before she played one of her favourites. Beattie, I'm all choked up after that. I feel like I've just sung four songs. I'm choked with emotion. There's lots of different things going on in those songs.
Subtle.
Is it all about you?
No, it's not. I mean, it all, I guess, comes from me.
Yeah.
Except, you know, the Cohen words. No, I think it's kind of universal psychology or, you know, emotions. So it's more that I hope that I'm just tapping into something that everyone feels.
It's the bloodstream of the human condition.
Exactly.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
We always wonder whether it's lyrics or music first with people, but when your songs are lyric heavy and they tell a story and all the rest of it, do you think that? Do you tack that onto a melody first, or do you have something running through your brain and you put the words on later?
Kind of. A lot of the time they happen at the same time, which is odd because I will just press record on my iPhone and I'll have a sense that
our
something...
Our kids today...
I know. No, on my old
home recording kit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. And then I just sort of, you know, the words come out and they are on top of the guitar part I have. I rarely change much. It just usually happens quite naturally in one go. So it's almost like a improvisation that turns into a song.
That's kind of nice. And I guess songs happen when you're on your own, maybe strumming away and riffing and practicing. When they're transformed with the pack, with Adam and Yaron, as we've just heard, that must be kind of a nice moment when you get to flesh them out. You know, that I presume is when you kind of go, actually, this is a really good song. Oh, this is good. Now this works.
Definitely.
Or do you always know? Do you always have a kind of get a tingle down your spine when you know you've kind of written a really lovely little melody?
I think the way I know is if it is going around in my head for 4 days after.
Yeah.
It's not usually, songs will go... They'll sort of be on repeat for an evening. But then if it's day four and I'm like, what is that song? And then I'm like, oh, it's mine.
Yeah.
I usually get a sense that then it works because it's really hooked into something that it's sort of subconscious and it just keeps reoccurring, which is great.
And it's all about life. You're a very busy girl. It seems to be constantly... When we look you up, you're kind of constantly touring and bouncing around from New York back to London, et cetera. What's your summer sort of shaping up in terms of sort of live stuff, and where can we see you other than obviously on Monocle Radio?
Yes, well it's been incredibly busy. It's been great fun, but lots of fingers and lots of balls. Sounds a bit dodgy.
Are you trying to say lots of fingers and lots of pies?
Yeah, and I was also thinking of the juggling balls.
That's a great analogy, lots of fingers, lots of balls. Yeah. I've only got 10 fingers. There's so many balls out there. Man, live.
Yeah.
That's given me a great idea for a song.
I think so. So, no, it has been. I've been making a lot of trips to the States, and I have to go back in, I don't have to, but I'm going to go back end of July to shoot a music video in San Diego for a few gigs, I think, in LA, and then a festival in New York. But then I come back, spend a few more weeks in London in August, and then I kind of go out there in September for residency stuff.
And how's that work? How's the New York crowds, the LA crowds, how do they differ? Because it's quite, your sets are intimate sets because of the nature of the music as well.
Yeah.
So how does that work? Are they appreciative? Are they standoffish? Because obviously you started touring in London.
Yeah.
You started gigging around London. What are the two crowds like? How do they differ?
They're both brilliant.
Hooray. You don't have to like one more than the other.
No, I know. I think that...
sure, they both have equal, different qualities,
yeah,
but they're
absolutely,
equally fine.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what I like about London crowd is you know you've done a good job when someone says, oh, yeah, well, that was all right, wasn't it? Or something of that sort. Whereas in the States, generally people love it all the time. And
yeah,
that's really great. And I'd like to think that it's, you know, genuine. And I do believe that. But I think it's just that yes attitude, which you get more with, you know, American...
They kind of know what's expected of them. Like a crowd kind of know that, you know, and I think on Broadway, when you go and see a play on Broadway, like
yeah,
there's a standing ovation for everything every night.
Exactly.
People kind of realise that being part of the crowd is sort of part of making the gig good for everybody else.
Yeah. And I think they celebrate passion and enthusiasm more, whereas I think... Londoners and well, especially Londoners, I think it's slightly more cryptic.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more, you know, we play it down more. And that's also good because, you know, you genuinely know if someone is keen.
No, someone's telling the truth when they say that's great. Does traveling, does it broaden your sort of songwriting palette? Is it a good thing to do?
Definitely.
I mean, do you write on the road? I guess you must do.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually wrote quite a few of the, because we've just recorded and we're mixing and mastering at the moment these songs which are going to be released as six singles, and we've shot we're shooting all the videos for those at the moment. But a lot of those, or three out of the six, I wrote in either Boston, New York or DC, like just random places where I kind of got a moment to myself. And yeah, it was really conducive to that actually, because you're just taken out of your comfort zone, and then you know, you don't fall into a routine of, okay, I'll do this at this time. And, you know, and London is great, but I really have to force myself to take some time to actually not, you know, be on the computer or...
On your iPhone?
Oh, my iPhone.
That's the truth. It's the songwriting truth is out there. That's
yeah,
exactly how they're all recorded. All right, Beatty. Well, thanks for letting us
thank you
shining
very much
a light on the songwriting process,
yes,
and for playing your lovely Midori.
Thank you.
Thanks
for inviting me.
A chair sat stiffly by the fire. It felt the warmth, but no desire. Still I long to touch your mouth. My wooden arm tried to reach out. Reach out. With haste. And as I sit a little stiff, I feel it's better to resist the lick of passion, the burning scar for my own internal fire. Such a beautiful affair, but you were late and I was stuck somewhere. And with our hands untied, would you like to take a share? Oh, it could have been such a beautiful affair. But you were late and I was stuck somewhere. And with our hands untied, would you like to take a share? Oh, it could have been such a beautiful affair.
That was A Beautiful Affair by B.T. Wolfe, and you're listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My name is Robert Bound. Still to come in part two of this show are these things. Joe Bullman talks shooting London's street history. People in Toronto talk about their North by Northeast music conference. And we go to Euro 2012 for a minute of sound, which is basically saying, switch off and you're square like a square's square. The Culture Show loves documentaries, but they often seem didactic, lazy things, don't they? Not Joe Bullman's, though. London-born and bred Bullman has directed two of a BBC series entitled The Secret History of Our Streets, about his hometown and its none richer street history. I talked to Joe about why he felt compelled to put it all down on film.
I grew up in the glamorous suburb of Romford in Essex, yeah, on the east side of London. My family were original East Enders, dock workers and shipwrights, and they sort of migrated out to the suburbs, got to the first set of fields and council estates and settled down there. But I've always been fascinated by London, and I would come in, you know, into town on Liverpool Street Station, and it was like entering this new world. I guess, you know, fast forward many years later, and I was sitting in a sort of greasy spoon with one of my colleagues, another director, a guy called Brian Hill, trying to work out what we should do next. And I'd become aware of this survey by Charles Booth. Charles Booth started work in 1886, and his plan was to visit every single street in London and to categorise each and every street according to its social standing, its class position. And he did that with a team of other people. It took him 17 years.
Was this a commissioned report? Was this a man with quite a lot of spare time on his hands and a decent supply of notebooks?
Absolutely the latter. He was obviously a complete nutter. He was a shipping magnate from Liverpool. And at the time, there was he started working in 1886, which is the year of the original Bloody Sunday, when there were 1886 and the following year, 1887, really big demonstrations in London. And the sort of governing class in this country had a real sense that England, Britain, was on the verge of revolution. They were really scared. If you go back and read the Times and the Telegraph and those kind of journals at the time, people really felt that England was teetering on the brink. And one of the reasons, the biggest reason they felt, was this big, they called it a substratum, and they meant an underclass of people, jobless, unemployed, loutish in their eyes, not bought into the sort of Christian values of mainstream England, that were threatening the state of the nation, were threatening the polity. And Charles Booth took issue with the Marxists who were saying there were a given number of poor people in London at the time. He said, that's nonsense. That's a wild overestimate. What I'm going to do is launch this survey and prove you wrong. At the end of 17 years, he worked out there were actually many more poor people living in poverty in London than the Marxists even had thought.
But over those 17 years, he went to every street, rich, poor, middle class, produced this series of stunning maps, which are, you know, among the great sort of icons of 19th century England, where London is covered as a series of colour-coded streets from yellow for the servant keepers all the way down to black for vicious and semi-criminal.
That's the verbiage of how Charles Booth describes these things that come out in the films as well. It's kind of, they're sort of colloquial slightly, like well-to-do, with hyphens between them,
and then
vicious and semi-criminal. They're sort of kind of quite, not arbitrary necessarily, but sort of strangely colloquial ways to categorise people.
Yeah, well, I think you have to remember he was probably doing among, you know, the very first social science. Yeah. This is a guy who forged, you know, a human endeavour, and he had this real... The Victorians generally, and Booth in particular, thought that if they could quantify the people living in every single street in London... they could somehow start to understand and therefore solve the problems that the country was facing at that time.
So it's a classic sort of idea, Victorian idea of engineering it, being able to engineer a success.
Social engineering. He ended up with, I think, 17 or 19 huge volumes, hundreds upon hundreds of notebooks, which you can still go and consult at the London School of Economics, and these maps. And when you look at his achievement, there is nothing like it. It is the greatest social survey for what I still would say is the greatest city on earth.
Yeah.
You know, it's an immense achievement that is almost routinely overlooked by social scientists. And we kind of sat there and thought, well, what could we do something here? Could we go back and maybe revisit some of the streets that Booth went to in the 1880s and the 1890s and see what's happened to those streets since?
And how did certain streets jump out at you from Booth's survey of every street in London? Deptford High Street and Portland Road in Notting Hill are the two that you focused on particularly. How did they jump out at you?
You know what? We kind of looked at Deptford High Street, walked up and down it. It's a stone's throw from... you know, the biggest financial centre in the world. It's a few miles from the City of London, the financial centre. You could literally lob a stone across the water and hit Canary Wharf, and yet it is, by anyone's standards,
other people
dirt poor.
Spitting distance.
Spitting distance.
If you
distance.
Don't like the city, if you call it a stone's throw, you call it spitting distance.
I could have said it with much more economy. Thank you, yeah. It's spitting distance, and yet it is dirt poor. It's one of the poorest commercial shopping streets in London. And when we went back and looked at what Charles Booth had to say about it, it was clear that the high street itself was surrounded by a community of these black streets, vicious and semi-criminal streets. But when Charles Booth got to the high street, it was red. It was well-to-do. There were shopkeepers living on it who kept their own servants. You know, it was an incredibly prosperous, thriving place. And so we said to ourselves, well, how come... you know, here we are starting in the 1890s and we got this, you know, the Oxford Street, say, of South London. And now we've got this desolate place where the shops are closing down and people can't make a living. What's happened to that street in the interim? And really what we tried to do in each of the films was to bore down, to drill down into the history of an individual street. It was quite a hard thing to do because, you know, the best story was always two streets away. And at first it felt very limiting. We're saying to ourselves, Jesus, why aren't we doing a history of London or at least Deptford? But the more we drilled down into these streets, the more you came across stories which really intersected with all these great, vast social forces that really have shaped a nation. And actually, when you get down to it and you look at this kind of spatial history, you know, of a very, very particular, singular place, it actually becomes the history of a nation. We were lucky. We didn't know that was going to happen. We were just lucky, I think.
Yeah, and the style of the films where you do very much take Booth's maps as a starting point, and you zoom down, and there's some nice work around the maps itself. When they zoom out and you see the whole of the rest of London to put the streets that you talk about in your films in context, were you surprised that it told a story? You know, each person's story, each house, whether it's a slum or Millionaire's Row, sort of is a microcosm of the story of London.
It was shocking because I think when we started out, we really didn't know what stories we were going to tell. Yeah. We thought long and hard about what streets, but in the end, we were a bit pickled. We kind of thought, well, you know what? Let's just pick six typical London streets. And we didn't go for, you know, I don't know, Park Lane and Bond Street. We went for just ordinary shopping streets, ordinary residential streets. And it was shocking to see what had happened on those streets. And...
We never went into a street with a predetermined idea of what the story, what the narrative arc was going to be. We really let the people, the past, the former and present residents of those streets tell us their story. And I think that's something that's a little bit different about the films.
Yeah, your films are very undidactic. They're nice in the subjects of the films, the people themselves tell the stories.
Yeah.
And just to go back to maybe finally to the engineering of the film, you said that in order to sort of canvas opinion and get people to see if they wanted to be involved in the film, you literally walk up and down the high street with flyers, knocking on people's doors, putting leaflets through people's letterboxes. That's a really sort of, that's a very effortful way of putting a film together. And I presume that is the idea of unless you are taking a thesis, unless you're taking a didactic approach to a film, you essentially have to canvas everyone on that street to see what their story is, how long they've lived there, what their ancestors did or didn't do, and all the rest of it. How long does it take, sort of beginning and end, from beginning to end, to get this thing together?
Yeah, really good question. It is very effortful. Not only all the residents of a street or all the shopkeepers in a street, but all the former residents. You want to try and get hold as many of them as you can. You know, one street we did in Notting Hill, which I think most people will know what kind of a place Notting Hill is now. It's a sort of, you know, the houses on the street are £6 million homes for hedge fund managers in some cases. But Portland Road used to be a street that was one of the worst slums in London. And the big grand 1850s houses that were built were never rented to well-to-do people. They couldn't rent them out. So they rented them to very poor people by the room, by the night. And we had to go back into the past and back into the suburbs to find some of the original inhabitants of that street, as well as the present day inhabitants. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of looking.
Presumably there's a lot of historical records you have to go through. This isn't Google, is it? Presumably are spending a lot of time in town halls and libraries up and down, from here to Essex and back again.
You make films and documentary films, historical films. And the first thing you do is look for the experts, and they'll tell you everything. But once we'd read a couple of pamphlets and a book, maybe there was a book, we were the experts on Deptford High Street or Portland Road, Notting Hill. There were no experts. We were it.
Yeah.
And while the film was being transmitted, the TV historian, David Starkey?
Yeah.
Tweeted to say, you know what? This film could have done with the services of an eminent historian. We wondered who he meant, could it have been him? But you know what? We didn't have the services of an eminent historian. We had the people of Deptford and the people of Notting Hill and the people of London. And we gave those people the chance to tell their own story for themselves, unmediated by some posh bloke, strutting up and down, doing pieces to camera. And we're really proud that we did that for many reasons. But the biggest one of all is that when you let people tell their own stories, they tell you a surprising story. We all thought we knew the history of, these streets. Actually, every single film in this series is a revelation. So we're really proud that we did that.
And that was Joe Bullman talking us through a bit of London's crazy rich street history. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Next, Toronto, my dear.
Weekends on Monocle 24 are for relaxing, taking stock of the week's events, and keeping an eye on the week ahead. The Review is our hour-long Saturday show, looking back at the books, TV shows, films, and events that have made our week, as well as a regular magazine review. Monocle Weekly, our original audio offering, is where it all started. Tyler Brulé, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck discuss the week ahead with guests, analysis, and a good helping of music. Perfect Sunday listening. And if you need a short, concise summary of the week's highlights, look no further than The Curator, in association with Rolex, a one-hour roundup of all the juiciest bits of the past week on Monocle 24. So listen to The Review, Monocle Weekly, and The Curator for the full Monocle 24 weekend experience, either live on Monocle 24, on our timeshift player at monocle.com, or on iTunes.
They say money makes the world go round, and all this week on Monocle 24, we'll be taking a closer look at the notes and coins in your pockets. From the ubiquitous dollar to the creaking euro, and taking in a few more extreme examples along the way. So tune in for The Currencies every day on The Globalist and The Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24.
Founded in 1995 and patterned after Austin's South by Southwest Festival, North by Northeast in Toronto has grown into Canada's biggest and most important music conference. What started out as just a music festival is now a respected film festival and interactive conference. Over its 18 years, the festival has grown and changed along with Canada's music industry, reflecting changes in business, which has kept the festival fresh and people coming back each year. Now more than ever, showcase music festivals such as North by Northeast seem crucial not only for bands' careers, but also promoters, booking agents, brands, the media and record labels to network and show off their skills and talent. Marcellus was there this weekend.
There's a great vibe across Toronto this week. It's hot out. Everyone is in shorts, on patios, drinking, eating tacos, and running around between gigs, films, free parties, and there's even shows on islands, beaches, and in people's backyards. Yep, it's time for Canada's biggest annual music industry festival, North by Northeast, billed as Canada's take on South by Southwest. Music industry folks and fans come from all over Canada, the USA, and Europe. But why? I asked festival manager Cam Carpenter, what makes North by Northeast special?
Because there's a phenomenal film festival that's been going on for 12 years, and for young bands, it's probably the best A&R festival on par with South by Southwest in North America. There are a million bands playing all over Toronto. They're phenomenal. They're young. They're hungry. They want to get signed. So unlike other conferences that there's a lot of sit-down business going on, this is about going from bar to bar and seeing a million great bands and a million great films.
After 18 years, over 650 bands, 50 stages, 40 films, 80 interactive sessions across 7 days in Toronto, the annual economic impact of North by Northeast on the city is $47 million.
There's thousands of people buying wristbands, hanging out at Yonge and Dundas Square, going to bars, putting money into the horseshoe, into restaurants. People are going to Java for their $10 curry meals, staying at the hotels. It's got to be a huge economic windfall for the city.
We know it's good for the economy, but what do bands hope to get out of the festival? Is there still the dream of being signed by playing a showcase festival?
It's all about, right now, it's not about getting a record, major record label deal. It's just about getting exposure. So I think it's important because the right underground people will find you. It's not about MCA or RCA showing up and writing a blank check, which they don't do anymore. It's just about finding an audience and people who love you and doing the deal on your own. So, you know what? It's harder to get an agent than it is to get a major record company deal right now. And the agents are the new pimps of the entire industry. Everyone needs an agent. That's how you make money. You go on the road and you play a bar that has 300 people in it. You sell t-shirts.
My name is Eli Klein. I'm an agent at The Agency Group in Toronto, Canada. Well, as an agent, I have about 6 acts playing the festival this year. Multiple shows, probably 10 or 12 shows between the 6 acts. And, you know, I work with the festival throughout the year to sort of plan which, you know, what acts I'm sort of prioritizing for this time frame. Some travel in, some are local. But yeah, I mean, our company works very closely with North by throughout the year too. I mean, I think probably we have 50 or 60 bands playing.
Hey, I'm Eric Warner. I run We Are Busy Bodies, a record label based in Toronto that primarily puts out vinyl records. I also put on concerts, festivals. I manage a bunch of bands. So with North by Northeast this year, I am running a showcase for my label, We Are Busy Bodies. It's featuring Limblifter, a band that hasn't really existed in probably about 8 years. I'm reissuing their first record. It's the record release. I hope to meet lots more people, to have people like the bands that I work with. I've been fortunate to meet lots of great people each and every year, and there's, again, so much going on, so many great people that come to town for a festival like this, so it's a chance to see friends I don't get to see very often, to see a few bands I really want to see, and then to really, again, expose people to the bands that I work with.
Well, on one hand, I have about 50 bands that I'm, like, excited to see. I'm not going to be able to see all of them, but I'm really actually hoping that I have, you know, I come out of this weekend with two or three acts that I'm really going to chase down and sign, hopefully.
And what makes North by Northeast cool?
I think North By, as opposed to Canadian Music Week, which I've been to everyone as well, and I think it's a fantastic conference, but North By has always been more about the public and the streets and the bands and the film, and it just seems less industry and more real in a lot of ways. It's just, here's the art. Yeah. Enjoy it.
It's performance, and that's kind of what the industry people that are here like to see. They want to see how the bands and the films play on real audiences. Yeah. And that's what we provide. We provide, like, they're just people that love music, love film.
There's a real cool factor to North By that that I think really helps certain bands get noticed, especially the smaller stuff. There's also a lot more room for sort of conceptual, I really like that North By has lots of partnerships and participations with other festivals and other groups. For example, the Brews Cruise that's going on Saturday, that's a partnership with Panache Agency in the U.S. Yeah. And M for Montreal Festival, which is a sort of similar conference in Montreal.
They've only begun, I think, to really show what they're capable of. I mean, it's been around so many years, but I think the last few years, like, they're open to day parties, they're open to, like, unofficial shows, they're open to, like, everything weird, and they're open to helping promote it, because they see the value in fostering a certain, awareness and, like, acceptance for everything else going on. It's going to, because at the end of the day, their shows are going to still be packed, and they're only going to be helping other people help promote their own brand.
How do you schmooze or meet people at a festival like North by Northeast?
It's like, read name tags and look over and don't be afraid to introduce yourself. Don't be too openly aggressive to someone. But if you recognize a name or a company name, just walk over and hand a business card or say who you are or buy them a beer. And if you have a business card, I just want you to remember my name. I'll send you an email saying where I met you and can I follow up with you in a week or two. And that's how I started my entire career, like hanging out at 3 days in March in the late 70s at the Harbor Castle and just looking for record company badges and starting to talk to people and getting to know their names. And I've signed bands at North by Northeast over Jägermeisters at the Bow Line, just going, you know what, we have to do this deal. I want to manage you. Let's toast. And I did that with Amos and Transparent and a couple of other bands.
Feist broke here, like, 4 or 5 years ago, like whatever. So there is the sense and hope of discovery that motivates viewers.
1, 2, 3, 4, tell me that you love me more. Please. With the music industry rapidly changing, with technology, revenues in live music, and branding, it seems industry showcase festivals such as North by Northeast are more and more important and relevant to a band's career. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Mar Sellers.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Now for a minute of sound. This one was culled from the histrionic inevitability that was the opening ceremony for the Euro 2012 Football Championships, taking place in Poland and Ukraine. Gabriele Buzek got this stuff while ensconced in the crowd in Warsaw. Spoko, kilka leci, hel wysoko, wszyscy razem zaśpiewajmy, naszym doping dajmy.
Yeah.
Good, huh? That was Gabriela Buszek at Euro 2012 in Warsaw. And that's about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be doing some more naughty things, I expect. Do you know what? For the moment, they're pending. We'll keep our powder dry. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and this show was mixed by James the Full English Bacon. Time for one final song this week, Beattie Wolf performing for us a cover of Leonard Cohen's rather beautiful A Thousand Kisses Deep. See you next week, and thanks for tuning in.
Came to me this morning and you handled me like meat. You'd have to be a man to know how good that feels, how sweet. My mirror twin, my next of kin, I know you in my sleep. And who but you would take me in a thousand kisses deep. I loved you when you opened like a lily to the heat. You see, I'm just another snowman standing in the rain and sleet, who loved you with his frozen love, his second-hand physique. With all he is and all he was, a thousand kisses deep. I know you had to lie to me. I know you had to cheat to pose all hot and high behind the veil of sheer deceit. Our perfect porn aristocrat, so elegant and cheap. I'm old, but I'm still into that. A thousand kisses deep. I'm good at love, I'm good at hate. It's in between I freeze. Been working out, but it's too late. It's been too late for years. But you look good, you really do, they love you on the street. If I could move, I'd kneel for you, a thousand kisses deep, a thousand kisses deep. The autumn moved across your skin, I got something in my eye. Light that doesn't need to live, doesn't need to die. Riddling that book of love, obscure and obsolete, till witnessed here in time and blood, a thousand kisses deep. And I'm still working with the wine, I'm still dancing cheek to cheek. The band is playing Auld Lang Syne, but this heart will not retreat. I ran with Diz, I sang with Ray, but I never had their sweep. Till once or twice they let me play a thousand kisses deep. Oh, I loved you when you opened like a lily to the heat. You see, I'm just another snowman standing in the rain and sleet, who loved you with his frozen love and his second-hand physique. With all he is and all he was, a thousand kisses deep. But you don't need to hear me now, and every word I speak, it counts against me anyhow. A thousand kisses deep.